that was asked was the one on reactionary. What exactly does that mean, and does that mean that we cannot plan ahead? I think what I was trying to say was just to explain the background behind the provision of legal services, because traditionally people contact or consult legal services when there is a problem. And technically, in practice, legal services is mostly about troubleshooting. When there is a problem, that is the time that legal services usually intervenes and find means and ways of solving the problem. However, that does not necessarily mean that we will not plan ahead. We can and we will plan ahead and make sure that we develop, excuse my throat, Chairperson and members, we make sure that we put systems and procedures in place to ensure that the pieces of legislation that we have to implement, especially IPED, are properly implemented, and also make sure that in instances where the law is silent on a particular matter, we issue directives or instructions so as to guide investigators and the work that they need to do. And with regard to contracts, we will obviously develop pro forma contracts and pro forma SLAs. And in instances where, and members have already elaborated on this point, to say, as IPED, we do not necessarily have to wait for somebody to lodge a complaint before we start investigating. And we saw us also playing a proactive role there to say, the moment we see press clipping or we hear anything in the news about a particular matter, we should be able to advise the relevant provincial office on the next steps that they should take. And one of them is to say they have to start investigating. Even if later on they discover that there is no case, but an investigation has to be done, we will be able to make sure that we act proactively on matters. But the reason why I mentioned the word reactionary is that we also have to be mindful of the fact that our main clients as legal services is the investigators. The moment they call, what it means is that depending on how urgent, and in most cases I would assume that their request will be urgent, we have to be able to put some of the things that we're currently doing aside and attend to that matter so that we do not necessarily create unnecessary bureaucratic processes in the system. I hope I have been able to answer the question. Thank you.
Move on. Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. I'd like to take this opportunity to address some of the questions which are relevant to my portfolio. One of the first questions which was posed was, who determines budget allocations? Budget allocations are determined by National Treasury through the NTF period, and that cycle involves your Minister's Committee on Budgets, National Treasury, the departments, and the budget allocations are done within a relevant cluster. The cluster we fall under is the Justice and Security cluster with our fellow departments. So that is how the budget is allocated to departments as such. I hope
if I may, are you saying that that committee advises the Treasury so on what is actually needed? So in other words, it's that committee that told the Treasury that you don't actually need all the money you asked for?
I wouldn't say that is the case. What happens is the departments would put forward their budget requirements align with their strategic objectives, what they intend to do with the budget. This budget submission, and you'd have discussions within the security cluster from all the departments as to what their needs are, and they would basically pose this to Treasury. Treasury will then take all of those into consideration and come up with a proposal which is presented to the various committees in the MTS cycle, one of those being the Minister's Committee on Budgets. There, the ministers are also afforded an opportunity to highlight specific areas where they would like to be seen or assisted by the budget proposals. But there are many people who contribute to the national budget. I don't think it's a single-handedly sort of somebody said, do not give the money to IPED. They had to do the best with the budget that was available to them, I think, in the national forum. Okay, in terms of, there was a question raised with CETA, the historic problems of invoicing. I think currently, to date, that situation has improved. We received all the invoices and we're able to effect payments on that. What caused a few problems in terms of payments in the prior was system problems with our BAS system, the transversal system. And that was because there was an upgrade in our IT software to Windows 7, but we were subsequently fortunately able to resolve that with the assistance of CETA, our internal IT department. So I think the invoicing problem has been addressed. We just unfortunately experienced system problems due to the upgrade, but those have been addressed to date. There was also a question on... the training budget. We're not sure, honourable members, where you're getting the statistics of the training budget decreasing. We suspect you may have done an analysis of the training budget per ICD staff member. We'd just like to get the opportunity to probably go and conduct that ourselves just to make sure we get in line with the decrease. I'm not sure if the honourable member could perhaps elaborate on the source of that information, but we currently aren't aware of a decrease in our total training budget, but maybe if we do an analysis for staff member, we need to evaluate if there's any decrease, I think, in real terms. In terms of asset management, the honorable members inquired as to whether we've had an improvement in the asset management of the department, as previously it was one of the problem areas. I'm fortunate to say there has been a severe improvement in that and respect in terms of asset management, physical asset management. We've established our SCM component, which is currently, I would say, fully staffed. We also have an SCM policy in place, which guides the guidance of SCM management within the department. We've also established the respective SCM committees, which include your bid committee, your disposal committees, just to mention a few. The immovable assets remain with the under auxiliary services, which is a component which falls under the program one management. So you have a split between your immovable and other assets currently to date. I'm not sure, I think that was the other question which was held, is whether there's any relation to asset management when it comes to the issues we're having now with immovable properties. Mr. Sosoba has explained to you, though, what the department has done to date in terms of immovable asset management. I hope I've addressed all the questions currently which relate, maybe.
Just one little outstanding one that I ask you in terms of the your increase in terms of investigation that I made the statement that I believe that it's artificial. Cosmetic of nature because of the fact that admin for this year is 47.14% of your budget, investigation 50%, 50.13%. Next year it would be 46.57%, administration, investigation 50.81%. I haven't done the 14, although it's 46% admin. And I said in real terms, you're actually decreasing in terms of investigators, obviously also in terms of administration, in terms of the things. And it's been a concern of this committee over the past 17 years that ICD then and IPED now are spending too much on administration and too little on your investigators. And can we get an indication? And I think it also touches on another question that is still outstanding in terms of the... your personnel structure, how many, not necessarily with you that question, but how many people were, etc. And I believe government criteria 3070, if I'm correct, administration to its core faction staff. And where do we stand in terms of IPED as far as that's concerned?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'll speak to the budget split. Under Program 1, for budget structuring purposes, all chief directors fall under top management, which is classified under Program 1. So if you look at the provincial heads who were previously at the director level, they used to be housed under Program 2. with now the upgrading of all the provincial heads, all the budget allocations for those have now been moved over to Program 1 as they now form part of top management. So that's why you find, I think there was a graph where I depicted that Program 1 had a growth rate which was slightly higher than Program 2. That was obviously also due to the costing of those provincial heads who now fall under Program 1 instead of Program 2. I think I'll hand over maybe to someone else for the staff establishment.
Thank you for that. Whoever's going to respond on that. I think it remains important that we actually do get a breakdown of your staff components for each of these units. Because the immediate follow-up question that comes as a result of that answer is, yes, your chief director, who is now provincial aid, falls under there, and that would explain some of the cost. But is that chief director also going to carry cases? Is that chief director also going to conduct investigations? Because if he or she is actually not going to conduct investigations, then they are just an administrative management person. And while they do play a role in terms of the investigation capacity, the fact is what we want to see is that IPED starts spending money, and therefore I don't have a problem with legal services either, because I think legal services and the advice that they give to the investigators would improve the quality of the investigations that are conducted and the preparation of case dockets once it goes to the public prosecutor. But we want to see a shift, and we've asked for the shift. Those of you, and they're getting less and less, and I'm glad to see they're getting less and less, of the old people who've been here before would know that we've always said you are spending too much money on administration and too little money on your actual core function. And this budget still doesn't give us the idea that there's a shift. So what we need to see is, Chairperson, and that's why I asked for the figures as well, how many administrative staff are there? The question that we asked police stations and that we asked police, how many uniformed police officers versus your PSA staff? How many actually involved in the investigations versus your administrative? And we need to know also, that's a question that is still outstanding, I don't know who's going to deal with it, what is your current vacancy rate? Given the fact that you've got to appoint a number of people this year because of the growth and a number of people next year, what is your current vacancy rate and what have you got in place in terms of making job tenure, secured job tenure, that you don't have this high turnover?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Most of the response we would prefer and request to submit in writing so that we give accurate information if it's okay. Otherwise, as I explained during my presentation, that we've got the staff complement of on our structure of 337. 337 officials. So the breakdown on how many are on Program 1, how many are on Program 2, and so on, we would request to submit that in writing, if it's okay.
No, well, we can accept that, the 337 breakdown. The fact of the matter is, one of your critical performance indicators last year was your vacancy rate, and was bringing down the vacancy rate. So that question remains. You've got on paper you've got 337, but in actual fact, how many people are you currently paying a salary for? How many of those positions are filled? How many still need to be filled? How many of them are from the old structure and how many are from the new structure? And if you can't provide it to us now, that's fine. But I think my concern is that it's not part of the current performance indicators as well, because it's always been a problem, and it's one of the problems is not only your turnover, but also the time that it takes for you to fill positions, is that it takes very, very, very long for ICD previously to fill positions, vacant positions, and some of it was said because of the policing powers, but there are other reasons as well. So can we get an indication of what's being put in place to address that?
Thank you, Honourable Member. On our structure, of 337, we've got 33 positions that are vacant. However, the breakdown of which of those positions are came with the IP or from the ICD side, we will also provide a detailed response on that, included on the on the whole issue of HR as it has been raised.
Honourable members, in terms of vacancy rates, that is still one of the performance indicators. We've kept that performance indicator from the previous year to make sure that we ensure that the vacancy rate is maintained below 10%. So it has been indicated as one of the performance indicators, just to address the question.
What's not addressing my question is what is your current vacancy rate? I mean, apart from the 33 that you talk about, because the 33 is, as you say, you can't give us a breakdown of what of that comes from the ICD and what comes from the IPEC. But now, fine. Give it to us later. That's fine.
You will definitely respond in writing so that we get accurate figures. Okay. Any other questions that are still outstanding?
From the members, there's nothing from the side, but if there's anything the members can remember, we will.
So it's just the issue of the 30 days after completion and the continuous feedback.
Respond to the interim asset movable policy, if not.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Members. I think we missed those questions. The interim policy on asset, I think this policy makes provision for specific duties to specific employees within the organization. So we call it interim because it was also still in the process of a consultation with staff within the organization. Hence, we call it interim. But it is an approved policy that we're using henceforth. Once these consultations have been completed, it will be a fully-fledged policy, not an interim, as you call it. With regard to feedback, this feedback, as we indicated here, refers to 30 days within which or after we have completed an investigation that the stakeholders must be informed of that outcome. However, we have the standard operating procedures which provides for an acknowledgement within 7 days of receipt of a complaint and for providing feedback on a monthly basis to our stakeholders. So that is a standard practice within the organization. But with regard to, you see, once an investigation is completed, once an investigation is completed, we should be able to have a report completed and the outcome being reported back to the complainant or any stakeholder within that 30 days. And that is why we put it. I just hope it answers the question.
Sorry, Chairperson, but the question remains, how are you making sure that that standing operating procedure is actually adhered to? I can tell you. And Mr. Beekman is going to pull the few hair that he's got left out of his head. I can tell you that I laid a complaint 2009, just before the election, that I haven't received feedback. I haven't received acknowledgement of that complaint. I'm definitely not receiving monthly feedback. I still don't know where that case stands. That's just an example. I mean, if knowing how difficult I am, get that in an office, in a provincial office, and I get that type of non-feedback, what about the ordinary citizen?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we under normal circumstances in the management process of our investigation, case file goes through what we call a brought forward system, whereby case to must ensure that this thing happens. But over and above that, what we have built in, and now we have established the monitoring and evaluation unit within the department, which would then do inspections in offices and audits in offices to see to it that offices comply with the standard operating procedures. So that is what we've put in place. Currently, we've been having the committee that was responsible to that, but this work now will be done by a fully-fledged unit, which will ensure compliance to the standard operating procedures as well as the regulations that have been programmed.
Does this make out part of your performance agreement with your provincial aid?
Certainly, that is part of the performance agreement, not only with the provincial aid, but also with the investigators. Part of the KRAs of the investigators include that.
Thank you. Members, do you still want to ask your question?
One further question, and you've talked about the memorandum of understanding also with SAPS. Is there a possibility that we can see that memorandum of understanding? And can we get an indication whether that memorandum of understanding also includes and what measures you've put in place? You will recall that the IPED Act says that people can report cases also at the police station for you to investigate. Have you put in place certain measures? In other words, is there, for instance, a complaint book or a case opening book or whatever you want to call it, I don't know, not an OB, but an IPED register of cases at police stations? Are you considering doing things like that? And, you know, what are you doing in terms of making sure? Because it immediately increases the footprint of IPED. If you have that in place, and I know as a complainant, and I'm sitting in a rural area, and I've got a complaint that I don't have to travel or contact IPED wherever they are in the capital, but I can do it at the station, and the station's got an obligation then to send through that to IPED, and there's some sort of agreement between IPED and the station on how that complaint will reach IPED. Is there something in place?
Chairperson, there are discussions in that regard. I know also, for instance, provinces have been engaging with provincial commissioners specifically in that regard, so that they have special complaints desk in the police stations for members of the public to be able to complain. And remember that also the service delivery complaints as part of what the police must themselves take over that. So what we've indicated is that we should be able to have a record of that, so that also when members do their oversight, they can see a register where they can go to in terms of how these cases are dealt with. So that is part of the engagements that we're engaging with the police about.
Comment on that. I'm worried about the fact that you say there are discussions with provincial commissioners. SAPS is a national competency, and that. If it's going to be something that's going to happen, it should be a national instruction. It comes from national level. It should be negotiated at a national level, I believe, for all stations then to implement. So I'm worried if provinces are doing their own thing around it and if it's not driven from the national.
Thank you, Chair. I was just indicating that also at that level, because at this present juncture, the MOU has not been signed off yet. But it's something that we're discussing at that level also, so that it becomes also part of their directives as national SAPS. The directive will come from the national commissioner.
You will now be expected to deal with systemic corruption in SAPS and as well as municipal police services. And the question will be, are there any measures that are put in place first to prevent corruption in the policing environment? And what are you going to do to ensure that corruption-related cases are processed and finalized on time? That would be my first question. CFO, you told us in the morning that you have spent almost all your budget for the previous financial year. However, according to information that is available to us, at the end of the third quarter, you had underspent. You were at 61.2% of all the allocated budget. And what reasons do can you give us to tell us that you did not just dump, do what is called fiscal dumping? And this question is very important to us because we are aware that other people fall to say buy and buy and buy. If you were at 61.2% when an actual figure is supposed to be around 75% as per your projections, and within 3 months you move from that, why should we not believe that you also are dumping the fiscus? My two questions. How are you going to deal with corruption?
Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to systemic corruption, the internal management, knowledge management unit of the department, it's busy looking at areas where, in terms of the cases that we've been receiving, where IPED can look at specific areas where we think there may be issues of systemic corruption to be able to look at start investigating those areas. Now, the corruption cases, corruption as a field of investigation, as I've indicated earlier in the in terms of training, that it's one of those that we have identified as a training intervention to make sure that our investigators also become specialists in terms of investigating cases of corruption. We have already, even in the IPED environment, had cases of corruption that we dealt with, even though we expect now in IPED environment that there will be more because the police are now obliged to report these matters to us. So we are confident that these training interventions that we have identified will also help us in terms of making a dent on those cases. What we have further done was to engage with, we recently had an engagement with the Americans to look at what kind of capacity they can also help us, not only the investigations part of it, but also equipment that you need to be able to do these kind of investigations. And we are in discussions with them in that regard. So in our view, we should be able to deal with these matters of corruption appropriately.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, we do take note that expenditure was below par in the third quarter. I did touch on it slightly during my presentation, but maybe just to elaborate on the causes for that and the expenditure in the third quarter. One of the causes was obviously the withholding of the payments for the leases to DPW, which we subsequently paid during the fourth quarter after advice from National Treasury and Senior Counsel. The next cost driver in terms of that was job evaluation results, which came later than anticipated, which means that those new appointments could only come through, the expenditure could only come through within the last quarter, which is the fourth quarter. And then one of the major sort of cost drivers to that under expenditure was the BAS problems that we experienced, which means that we had payments which could not be affected on the system because of the system problems that we were experiencing. So we had had BAS, for example, BAS payments batches which needed to go through the system, but we could not affect that because of the experiences, the problems we're experiencing with the system not accepting the entries that we're posting into them. But fortunately, CETA and our internal IT department was able to resolve that batch problem, and then we worked during the last quarter to make sure that we'd recorded all the expenditure for that year. So those were the main cost drivers, especially the boss back problems that we experienced. If you even look at the trend of our expenditure with even the first and the second quarter, you'd find that it was below par because of that very reason. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chair, just for clarity's sake, the one reason is you're saying job evaluation that was delayed. How does the job evaluation generate that you have a big expenditure, and what does it mean?
Maybe just in simplistic terms, if job evaluations are not conducted on new posts or funding that you've received for new people that you can appoint within that financial year, then we cannot effect those appointments until that process has been concluded. So there were a few posts where we needed that process to be officially concluded before we could appoint people. So the funding that you would receive would have been for the full year, which means that you can only effect that funding in the last quarter of the financial year.
I want to ask the executive director, whoever you want to delegate to answer this, I want to know practically, from IPET's side, how do you see things going from here on onwards? If I can use an example, and we talked about Falwater earlier. Just check the news again. This morning, a constable in Moore's police station killed his girlfriend at the station and then himself. Now, you read the statement, and again, it ends by saying police were investigating a case of murder. We need to get to a point where the last line says the ICD is IPED is investigating this case. So, practically, tell us what is in place. Why is it that on this day, granted 16 days after you came into existence, we still have a statement that says police are investigating a case of murder, when we all know that according to the Act it should be saying IPED will be investigating this issue? And the worst part, if you read this thing, is that the fight broke out at the station between these two. So this guy was carrying a firearm, et cetera, et cetera. But just give us practically, it comes back to my question, ensure me that we can stop worrying about these things. Because there is development in terms of the MOU. There is knowledge, supposedly. You've had workshops, et cetera. I don't want to see the police are investigating this. I want to see the last line saying the station commander has referred the case to IPED for investigation.
Madam Chair, excuse me, I want to step back to this question of the job evaluation. Maybe you should walk me slowly so I understand why the job evaluation that was delayed has effect of a balloon payment at the last quarter, like the chair was raising earlier on. What is it? What is the ingredient of this payment that we're talking about? Is it the post up later, the money is high.